This is Maria Rizaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I will interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. Think of a time of pestilence, of theatres being shut down, women dressing as men and men as women, and a whole pile of gender fluidity happening with the help of a scalpel. Sound familiar? Yes, you guessed it. It is the 1400s in Europe. This week's episode brings together a barrister and an actor, Kelly Edwards and Lex Marinos, and they are bound by politics, equity, and the powerful theme of blood, as in bloodline and just blood on the straight. Kelly, a barrister and anti-discrimination lawyer, shows her writer's side by showcasing her beautiful unfinished novel. She tracks the adventures of a young, well-born woman entering the all-male musical world, fighting the limitations of her sex. It is the story of the outsider, but it's the writing, its cadences and tones, which is the hypnotic thing about Kelly's work. It is very much like the troubadour music and lyrics, which so inspires her writing. Why, you can just imagine her words and this music echoing off those same stone walls. Poetic lyricism aside, there is a tough thread of political grit in these times. A critiquer is the highly respected Australian actor, Lex Marinos, who's not only a master of his craft, but a keen political activist. He knows what it is like to be an outsider. The Wog from Wagga, he jokes. He's not the type of fellow who gushes praise. In fact, at parties, he says he's the one that lurks at the kitchen door having quiet political discussions. Although the words quiet and Greek and discussion of politics in the same sentence, well, Lex is more of a serious Sophoclean type of Greek. And the story of a woman who dons men's clothes disguised as a troubadour in order to fulfill her passion for performance? Whoa. That unleashed the beast. He was inspired to wax lyrical about how the troubadours and actors of the time used to wander from town to town, playing undercover and sometimes illegally. I kind of get the feeling that Lex would have made a very good minstrel and wandering bard. I could see him now, practicing the lute on the back of a wagon. But hey, in these pestilential times of 2020, where theatres are closed, where we all feel like outsiders, in our own towns and cities, Kelly's novel holds a deep resonance, and maybe Lex's troubadour fantasies will come to life. So sit back and enjoy our gritty, politically astute interviewees as they kind of go all mushy about artistic expression. Kelly Edwards, welcome to the program. This is take two, as you know. Very quickly, just tell us a little bit about your background.
Started off life doing architecture, moved on to do a degree in communications while working full-time. Then I went off to do law, and so now I'm a barrister in the human rights space.
Just give us a little bit of an idea of your day job, as we call it, on this program.
Oh, do we have to talk about that?
I know. Because this is actually it. Like, we both attend the Saturday morning Zoom writers group. It's almost like a relief, especially during this coronavirus time, to have that space.
Yeah, I just love the Saturday morning group. That's a high point of my week. And
I know that a lot of the work that you do is quite confidential.
Correct.
By contrast, when we're in the writers group, nothing is confidential because people reveal themselves so much.
Or everything is.
Or everything. You know, more
it's fiction, isn't it? So who knows? Any good writer, what it exposes about them is their ability to imagine other lives. A well-written story allows the reader to insert themselves into it as if they are the main character.
When you're in the writing space, everyone agrees there's a kind of a mellifluous thing that happens.
I don't know how to describe that magic, except that often you sit down to write and you think the story is going in one direction, but then it doesn't. It goes in a completely different direction altogether.
Yeah. Well, tell me about your current story, because it is a story that has entranced a lot of people in the group. You had a week when you said, oh, I'm not going to read. And everyone went, what? Kelly's not going to read? We're not going to get that little bit of magic? Tell me where you are with that story.
Well, I think this story is issues that everyone's tackling at the moment. What is it to be a person of any kind of gender? What is gender anyway? How does gender influence the way in which you move in the world? And they're all issues that are interesting to me because of my work, but also just as a woman. And
yeah. The whole gender ID thing that happens in your book is about a woman disguising herself to be a man.
In the 1400s.
So I'd like to draw that little line between sense of this is a current issue and how you feel women are placed now.
I think the more things change, the more they stay the same. The story that I'm telling about this woman came to me because I've got a bit of an obsession with medieval songs and troubadour songs. It is a story really about any woman today. How do you have autonomy? How do you have authority to move in the world? Well, in her case, she was born to her father late in life, who was a rich merchant, that he was well-travelled and could speak many languages and treated her as a boy. And in fact, he christens her as a boy, which enables her to have an identity. He remarries and he dies, and she has to go back and live with the stepmother, and the stepmother wants to do all the usual thing, holds herself out to be a man. And of course, there are many men who at various times in the world's history removed their organs so that they would sing in a certain way. So that it was so far from reality that a woman could hold herself out to be a man.
So you were saying that you would start to get interested in this period because of music. The one thing that everyone comments on about your writing is its cadence, musicality, and its poetic flow. And so give me an idea of what it is about that music that you love.
What I love about medieval troubadour music is the sparseness. It's all about the beauty of the lone voice. What I love about in reading as well as writing is writing that is rich and potent, lyrical, pays attention to the rhythm and the sounds of the word.
You learn so much about yourself in becoming a writer, and it's a kind of humbling experience in so many ways.
Books enable you to put on someone else's body and travel around in the world and imagine what that would be like.
Yes.
Including thinking like someone else.
Most writers are avid readers. You know, it's almost like how you pick up the craft.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I love the J.D. Salinger saying, the only advice you need, and it's so simple, I hardly dare say it, which is write what you'd most like to read.
Mm.
It kind of brings to mind the, I think it was Jean Cocteau, who said, take note of what the critics say about your work and don't like about it the most, because that's the thing you most need to cultivate. I think that's really true.
Yeah.
But it does require you being brave enough to plumb those depths.
When we talk about the gender issue with Lucia, what is it that she's seeking in disguising herself as a man?
I don't think she wants what men want. It's not a story of sexuality at all. It's really about freedom, which is what everyone wants.
Yesterday you said something really beautiful about being called by certain characters, because Lucia is not an historical character.
She was always there.
You felt like she had always been there? How did that happen?
I think that it's a bit like, where do your children come from?
Yes.
You know, there are these characters that just appear when you put pen to paper. I've always had the sense of her, particularly, you know, when I listened to this music a couple of years ago and did some research into family history, trying to track down my dad's side of the family because there's some Aboriginal there. I thought I was the first to go to university, but no, that's not right. Took seven generations ago to find this family who were rich merchants. And there were these seven or eight children, and one of them was, in fact, a barrister like me in Lincoln's Inn. Two others, one was Thomas, and his brother was Henry Hillier, who was an architect and a surveyor and surveyed most of northwest Tasmania. I feel compelled to write about him. And yesterday I got quite emotional telling
you
about
did.
The... Because there's something about him that draws me to him, and I have this image of him standing in a field in Tasmania, and I can see it really clearly. I can see what he sees. We've got such a rich and long history, more than 60,000 years old. And all of us who came later share in that, to the extent that we love this country. And
the way you were describing it, it felt like it was in your cell structure somewhere. Well, he is in your cell structure.
Apparently.
All of a sudden it means something. You can feel traces of it.
It happens sometimes. Yeah. You just get this person comes to you and you've got to write about it. So I think writers are often outsiders, but they're survivors of being outsiders.
Yes.
They do what my character does in this book, which is they have so many skills at being able to see the situation and that they are also able to participate in a way that makes other people think that they belong.
Yes.
Even though they still carry the luggage of being the outsider.
So tell me, how does the whole novel start? Because her mother dies in childbirth. Everyone seems to die around Lucia.
Well, it's the 1400s. It's very dangerous.
100 ways to die in the West. 100 ways to die in the 15th century.
Oh,
Lucia was born at sea, early, on a high tide of blood from her mother's body. Her father, Bartolomeo, caught her thin, slippery small self and wrapped her clumsily in sheets ripped small, loose threads trailing from the unstitched edges through her mother's blood, painting thin, red, zigzag lines across the lurching deck as her father moved to a pot of water. He dipped some clean linen and wiped the blood from his daughter's head and beheld a shock of black hair under the red. When his child opened her eyes, he felt something shoot through him, hot, urgent, requited. He took the small bundle and put her close to his wife's face. "Look what you have done," words whispered soft in her mother's ear. He was wondrous of this miracle, so late in life, so long in coming. "Bartholomeus," her mother said something so quietly in her own language, he heard it as his own thought. She looked deep into her baby's eyes and then into his. Her mother was weak, but she held her lover's gaze with a strength of purpose known to him from their time together. He understood. She did not blame him for taking her from the place she felt safe. She did not reprimand him for ignoring her presentiments of danger, which he heard as fear of living in his country with his people. He understood she would haunt him forever in the almond eyes of her daughter. Her mother died in the late twilight of Midsummer's Eve as the sea went from roiling to smooth. They were not far from that island group where seafaring merchants had made themselves an order of royalty, governing much of the known coastal world. Venice was the beating heart of La Serenissima, its boats the arteries and veins through which the blood of commerce pulsed. Her mother's shroud was sewn from the canvas of an old sail, completed with a last stitch through the nose. She was lifted onto a plank, and from there the plank was placed onto the rail before they hoisted her head high, and she slid feet first into the moving blue surface. She floated for a while in the lee of the ship. There was air trapped in the bag that ballooned for a time before her minimal weight dragged her body beneath the surface. Lucia imagined her mother floating, her mother, the foreigner, not yet arrived in her husband's country, giving birth, dying, and then being sewn into an old sail, made for the wind, not the sea. Lucia knew the smell of old sails, of salt and oil, and imagined herself in her mother's place. "Was it dark when you put her to sea?" Lucia would ask her father. He did not reply. She imagined that it had been the afternoon and the sky was dark. Sometimes she imagined storm clouds covering the sun, or the kind of cosmic omens which caused the sun to disappear. Sometimes when she dreamt about her mother's death, the sun was obscured behind a wave, larger than any wave she had ever seen, which bore down upon the ship until they were all swept away. She would wake with her lungs bursting, trying not to breathe in the sea. She didn't tell anyone about these things.
I just love this work. You just want to lie back. It's a bit like opium. I've never taken opium. Sitting back on a lounge and just luxuriating in the wafting waves.
So Lucia grows up on a boat with her father, as I said, and Halil, who's the ship's doctor person, has a son, Aziz, and she falls in love with her, Aziz. Aziz's face was more familiar to Lucia than her own. It reflected her more accurately than the best-made mirror. In death, his reflections became only slightly less persistent in the attention they required of her. He was her and she was him. She thought they would grow old together. She had imagined they would live by the sea, somewhere warm, and Aziz would grow roses and pomegranates, and she would watch him, still wondering at his patience, an attribute she did not have, his gift for silence and his respect for living things. "We are blessed," she would have said, knowing there is only spirit and spirit is light, and all around them the sun on the water. Aziz would have said, "How many times? Do not say such things." But he would smile, not at her, at himself, because he knew better than to call in evil spirits by pointing in the direction of what he loved. Perhaps she could only already imagine it so well, it was never to be. Perhaps it is only what we are incapable of imagining that we must experience. Lucia dreamed of being able to imagine everything, so experience was at an end. What she did not imagine were the sounds of her father's footsteps, frantic, the colour of his blood like a fire burning from his neck, caught and stilled by the yellow dust of his feet, his face flung skywards for a moment before collapse, Halil's body beaten as he attempted to come between her father and the knife, Halil's limbs shuddering long after they ceased to hold the particular shape of his bones, Aziz's hand grasping her sleeve and pulling her away from the crowd, alleyways, streets, a stone caught in her shoe, the shoe kicked off and then lost, kicking over a glass bottle, shards into her left foot, running breathless into the low light of a many-domed mosque, the blood from her foot making shapes like red pansies where she had walked on the smooth, yellow, flesh-coloured tiles. They huddled behind a mihrab just inside the entrance, which was covered by a small dome, lined with small blue hexagonal tiles, the colour of deep water. She could see beyond the great dome tiled in emerald green. She stood in that small space with Aziz and saw them both reflected in the enamel tiles many times on all sides. She thought that if God had eyes, he would see like this. She did not imagine the soft skin on the back of Aziz's neck under her hands, the dip in his chest, her forehead against it, the movement of his heart, the crushing inescapability of grief. She did not imagine that she would later fashion music to the shape of his back, arched to reach deep inside her, that she would create music with a rhythm shown in the gesture of her hands and matching her own pulse, that she would bury in her breath, in the commonplace words she would sing, violent change, changing words by the placement of breath alone, making dangerous something otherwise placid. She could not imagine in that tiny space, with the eyes of God upon her, that her heart would turn inwards and she would create music, in which she would always hear his sadness, the completeness of his breath.
And that did not feel very opiate-like. That was very that was a very different experience. You and I, we're women. Why is it that we and Lucia, we fight that role?
We and and Lucia generally don't like to be told what to do. And we certainly don't like to appear as if we're behaving in ways that other people make it. And there is that conversation between her and Leon.
But I just want to hear some of that dialogue and that end sentence.
Okay. It was getting cold and his hands were aching, which probably meant evening rain. She turned her head again towards him. He could just make out the small movements of her lips pacing out the words which would accompany new music she had been working on. He looked down at his desk, let go of his hands, and took up his pencil again as he continued to draw. She looked up from her instrument. He pushed back from his desk and looked out the window. "If you have come here to disappear, I'm going to have to cast you out." He heard her take a deep breath and she started. "I miss my father." "Yes, but he didn't know what to do with you." "You mean you don't know what to do with me? To pretend you're someone else, to be who I am. What happens when you want to be a woman? I do not even know what that means."
And now to the critique part of our program. Now, you will note in this section, there'll be huge swathes of Lex Marinos just speaking. And that's not because he was talking over me. I'll just tell you that up front. It's just that there was so much girly giggling and pretty unprofessional gushing that was happening on my side. I had to edit it out. But my very valid excuse is, well, who cannot engage with Lex's passion on all the topics that he picks up? Lex Marinos, welcome to the program. This is the first time that I'm interviewing somebody who's outside of the writing field. But then, of course, I read your Wikipedia entry last night, and you've also written a book.
We've got a copy of it somewhere.
And Lex, right up front, always had a little bit of a crush on you. This must be difficult for you to handle.
No, I think it doesn't take long for them to come to their senses.
It doesn't last long. Okay. All right. You can test that theory out during the course of this interview. So your immediate impression?
Well, first of all, congratulations. Kelly's done a wonderful job. I love the opening. I like the style. It's direct. There's a sensuality about it. The interest of mine is the whole notion of ancestry and blood. Mm. And I love the fact blood is a dominant theme through that opening.
Yeah.
And then even Venice being described as thriving on the blood of commerce. I think that's a wonderful phrase. I mean, what intrigues me is the fact that it's set at a time when, you know, in the 1400s, and to go off and become a troubadour, I mean, she's already an outsider. And that choice takes her further outside of the conventional world. The further one takes oneself from that conformed world and that constructed world, the sharper the observation, the more clearly you can see the world that you're not a part of, and you may desire to become part of it. And I think most artists, whether they're writers or actors or visual artists or musicians, it's through the creation that they express themselves rather than the confidence to just be.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a common, I think, misconception that actors, for instance, are extroverts and and, you know, they're the life of the party and they're great at telling jokes. And I found it to be the furthest thing from the truth. I mean, you know, I'm the person who stands in the kitchen at parties and, yeah, you know, and doesn't. The whole notion of it being 15th century is a period that really fascinates me. As an actor, it fascinates me because we tend to think of the Dark Ages as being a time when there was no theatre. Mm. And there wasn't in the formal sense. The Romans had shut down the theatres because they'd into disrepute in the 6th century and, you know, there was a little bit going on in the churches, but generally it was strolling players. It was, yeah, they've closed the theatres because of the plague or because of the morality, or they've gotten rid of theatres, they've imposed all sorts of bans on congregations and things like that, and they have never stopped storytellers from telling stories. We wander the country, push our cart around with our costumes and our props in it. We lob into the next city that's having a fete on a Sunday or a Saturday. We do our juggling, we sing our songs, we do some acrobatics, tell a few stories. Look, you know, we busk for handouts, maybe something to eat, maybe a barn to sleep in, and then we load up the cart and go on to the next village. It was dangerous being a playwright, and it was dangerous being an actor, and you didn't make money out of it, and you weren't regarded.
Oh, welcome to our world, you know, acting and writing.
They never stop us. So that whole notion of a troubadour is something that is very dear to my heart. Essentially, we are still troubadours.
Troubadours and outsiders.
Kelly, I mean, she's chosen very specifically to create a gender outsider. Mm. You know, and given the period she's writing with, most women, all women were kind of outsiders. And she amplifies that by turning her into a troubadour, which takes her further away from so-called normal society. The memoir I wrote is called Blood and Circuses. So I'm attracted to that notion of blood is about our DNA and our ancestry and what we inherit. But it's also the thing that binds us. It binds us as a family. It binds us to give a generational continuity. You know, part of my blood is that of the outsider. And I understood what it was to be because we didn't fit the assimilationist policy at the time. They were very good citizens and great contributors to their communities. They were always wogs. They were always dagos. Mm-hmm. You know, they were always not. That was very much impressive because we were told on a daily basis that we weren't part of the host society.
You weevil in the carapace. And as Kelly says, you learn how to be like the insider. You never forget that you're not really inside.
First, one of the things I learned about being an outsider is it doesn't matter whether you're Greek or Italian or Lebanese or
whatever. You're just on the outside. Sometimes feel sorry for people who have always been on the inside. They just don't have any idea of the space and the magnitude it gives you to be able to observe. Like you've got 10 antennas instead of just 2.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. One of the signs for me of a good novel is that can be read aloud. There's a lot of books that once you try and read them aloud, they're really difficult. And I found Jane Austen difficult until I started to read it aloud and Henry James. And then you realise how beautifully crafted the sentences are. And it's almost epigrammatic. Each sentence contains a wisdom and a balance of its own, accumulates. And I think there's something of that in Kelly's writing. And I like the musicality of it. I mean, the hardest thing with any book, the biggest challenge is in that first page and a half, is to create the world and gain the confidence of the reader. I know within the first couple of pages whether I'm even going to continue. If the writer has been able to create a world that I'm interested in entering, remain a little bit standoffish until the writer really convinces me that he or she can take me on an interesting journey, I'd have no trouble following Kelly. I got that strong sense of she knew what she was talking about, the world that she'd created. Straight away, that sense of, you know, family choices, that notion of otherness is there right from the start. It's already a story about somebody who is, right from her birth, is looking to where, how she fits in. But there's an elegance about it that doesn't make it vulgar and sensational.
But I want to harken back to what you were saying just before the interview, which was about creating that clear channel. You as an actor sliding into a character and being a conduit for these words.
That's worth talking about.
Yeah.
I certainly feel that 50 years now. And if anything, I hope I've become better at just being the conduit for the story.
Right.
You know, not be getting in the road of the story.
Because this is what my writers say. The character takes you over.
But I mean, certainly it's true that the best performances are the ones where, you know, without sounding too mystic or anything, but the ones where you just open up and the story flows through you and time is suspended. And
do you feel like with Kelly's work that that conduit has been created?
I sense that Kelly is confident in her storytelling. And in a sense, you know, already Lucia has taken over the storytelling. So I feel that voice is very recognisable.
What about this thing about dissembling? I'm guessing it would have been really interesting and challenging and emotive to have played the part that you did in The Slap.
Oh, that was my dad. Indisputably, an elaborate kind of makeup because, believe it or not, they needed to make me look older. There was a bit of prosthetics going on. And there was a curious moment I found during that process. It was about a 45-minute makeup job. And somewhere around the mid-look in the makeup mirror, and I didn't see myself anymore. I saw my dad. And the first couple of times, it really upset me and threw me.
But look, you're storytelling now. I want to ask you something. Mm-hmm. What's your next big story? What story would you like to be part of next?
The big Australian story that's yet to be told. The true reconciliation between us migrants and the Indigenous people. And I think that's still got a long way to go. I know from Indigenous artists that I've worked with, there is a strong sense that the story is not yet told. You know, in a way, I feel that until that story is reconciled, we're never going to deal with the otherness of migrants either. Not that they're the same, but there is just a way that until we can break down that assumed privileged white middle-aged Christian
white bread.
The big Australian story that's yet to be told. You know, I have performed at the Opera House and I have performed around the country and I have done all of those things that I'd kind of had on my list when I was starting out. They may have been modest, but I enjoy working in a collaborative art form rather than, I mean, I find writing difficult because there's, you know, it's just me and the blank screen and I find that difficult. So that's what really gets me going. But a big reconciliation project is probably one that I'd love to have even a minor role in.
And that was the amazing Alix Marinos critiquing the equally amazing Kelly Edwards. I loved this episode. I'll even play a little bit of that troubadour music that Kelly likes, just in tribute. Okay, that's enough. See you next time. This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program, produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH with the support and inspiration of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I look forward to your company next time.